What is a galaxy?
It's a group of billions of stars.
That's it. The way the universe is designed, things tend to clump together. Planets clump together in solar systems, around stars. Stars clump together in galaxies. Galaxies clump together in super galaxies. Super galaxies clump together in super galaxies. They just tend to be in chunks out there. That's the way it works. So I just wanted to make sure everybody knows some of the basic terms, what a galaxy is. And does anybody remember the numbers? How many stars are there in the average galaxy?
Billions and billions.
How many billions and billions?
Well, that varies.
It does vary.
It's about, how many galaxies are there?
It's about 200 billion stars in a galaxy, and about 200 billion galaxies in the observable universe.
And that's 10 to the 22nd stars in the universe. Not counting...
It's about 50 billion trillion.
Are we recording?
Yes.
My high school professors lied to me.
Why is that?
Oh, because back in the 60s we were taught that the universe was infinite and God was dead.
No, the universe is not infinite.
Does every galaxy have a black hole in the center?
My understanding is yes.
The large ones, or the medium size to large, yeah. But the dwarf galaxies, they don't think you.
Right.
Now, how old is the Milky Way galaxy? How old is the universe? 13.7, very good. So was the Milky Way galaxy formed 13.7 billion years ago? Well, that's somewhere in the 9 billions they're projecting. Yeah, 9 to 10. So it's not as old as the universe. Kind of interesting, huh? And then when did it...
I don't think that's important for life. It was part of that. We wouldn't have to get any rocky planets.
Yeah. So, you want to? We do have a. I like this first question they came up with. Well, by the way, are there any on the video? Do you all have any questions? Anything you want to ask before we hit you with a few? Nothing right offhand. Well, if you think of something, just raise your hand. Janet.
This was in the Q&A. He said that. I'm not sure I understood it correctly. I think he said that 380,000 years old is the earliest that we can actually see, and that he extrapolated the rest of the time back to the trillionth of a trillionth of a second or whatever. Is that correct?
That's approximately correct, yes.
Yeah, anybody want to tackle that comment or...
Well, the answer was the polarizing light. So by analyzing the light from that time period, you can find out what happens sooner.
Exactly.
Hugh typically uses the grenade scenario that obviously, if you know, universe is expanding, if you know how it's expanding, you can look back, obviously, take your time, you can extrapolate, you know, you can see sooner from that.
But as far as visible light goes, yeah, it was 380,000 years ago that we first could see it. That's called the cosmic background radiation. And it was discovered in the 60s, 1960s. And so at that point, something happened in the universe physically.
So that, are we seeing 380,000 years ago, or when the universe was 380,000?
Pardon me if I said that.
The latter.
Yeah, the latter. When the universe was 380,000 years ago. Old.
That's the furthest back we can see.
Is when light separated
pretty
from darkness. And that's what we call the cosmic background radiation. Before that, Dave touched on it, they can somehow measure what they call polarized light, and they can take it back even further beyond what you see at the cosmic background radiation to... 10 to the minus, it's either 34th or 43rd a second. 10 to the minus second, that many seconds.
Yeah, that's to point out, that's actually directly observable, and then what he was talking about, the particle accelerators that we have here on Earth, is the other reason we're able to go back further in time. So it's not just the polarized light is not the only way we're able to go back and look at the very beginning of the game, part of the accelerators to simulate the conditions of the universe that we're going on also. So between the polarized light and the particle accelerators is how we know what the universe was like when it was very, very, very young. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a question, sir?
Yeah, you got one more thing for you.
I'm sorry.
I thought cosmic background radiation is nothing more than noise, but somehow you interjected light into that?
Well, it's electromagnetic radiation, which a light is in that category. So whatever wavelength is coming out of the cosmic background radiation, It's not visible light. It's a microwave, shorter wave, and so. But it's in that group of or that type of energy, you know, electromagnetic radiation.
And also, is heat. And then the other analogy you use obviously mm-hmm. is that if you turned on your oven really hot and you put sensors all over the room, temperature sensors, and if you open the oven door for just a brief period of time and shut it quickly, if you look at the sensors in the room, you'd be able to, you know, mathematically calculate out, you know how long ago that door was open, the temperature. And so that background radiation was critical and realizes the universe had a very hot beginning, you know, and it was one of those factors also for determining the age of the universe.
I want to ask a question. There's two reasons that Hugh gave as to why the section of our Milky Way galaxy can't be too tightly dense, too tightly packed around us. Two reasons. Does anybody remember what they are?
Light for observation.
And this, when I first heard Hugh say this one, I kind of blew it off. I didn't really appreciate it. But what he's saying is, and now I get it, it's really a argument for awe and beauty. What he's saying is that God put our planet in exactly the right place in our galaxy, and our galaxy in exactly the right place in the universe so that we can see God's handiwork. If there were a nebula or a collection of stars that were tightly packed, that was close to us, there might be imagine a whole section of the sky that's just whited out with something very close. We wouldn't be able to see past it, for one thing, and it would obscure so much of the rest of the sky for observing the rest of the sky. When you look up at the sky, other than the moon, you really are seeing a pretty consistent pattern in the sky. And what Hugh is saying is, it's designed that way so that we can see. It's just enough to impress us and not so much as to overwhelm our observational ability. That's a pretty remarkable argument.
You know, one more thing. What would it do if we couldn't see the stars and be able to go back to 10 to the minus 34 seconds? What would it do to Psalm 19? Anybody remember what Psalm 19 says? The heavens declare
the glory of God.
We wouldn't be able to, that would make Psalm 19 false if we couldn't see.
You know, you're looking it up. Would you mind reading it when you get to
it? The first four verses.
It's a pretty remarkable passage.
Yeah.
Okay, I buy the fact that under Hugo Ross's definition of creativity and God's existence, fine, we're at this interesting point in time in the universe and place, but what about any other type of different species that may have a different type of genetic makeup or whatever?
Let's hear Psalm 19 and we'll get right back to that.
Okay.
The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork.
Mm-hmm.
Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world.
Okay.
To them he has set a tabernacle for the sun.
Mm-hmm. So you know, coupling that with Ross's point, you know, it wouldn't work. You know, Psalm 19 would not make any sense if we weren't able to observe the universe the way we are now.
The heavens to hear. The heavens declare the glory of God. Well, they wouldn't be declaring the glory of God to us if it was so crowded that we couldn't see it.
I'll have to maybe a little rebuttal on that. If we had that situation, Psalm 19 wouldn't have been written, and we simply wouldn't have that concept as part of our scripture.
You sound like a skeptic.
That's right. That's right.
The author of both that and the universe are the same.
Is that the situation we have in Los Angeles where we have too much light from the city?
That's right.
Oh, we're getting to that. That's our first question, our first real question.
Well, we need to answer.
What's your name, sir?
John.
Okay, John, go for it.
20, 30 years ago, his question was a very valid point of science. You know, it said that there could possibly be life based on other something else. Silicon was a very popular element that was raised, that possibly you could
arsenic, have
microbes, you know, some type of life or even advanced life based on some of the things. In Star Trek, they have that a lot of stuff. But within the last few years, advancements in biology have come to realize that life has to be based on carbon, because carbon is the only element that has enough complexity to make something that's living. Silicon is not complex enough to produce a living organism. You can't produce cells, you can't produce anything with it, because it's not complex enough. And the next thing, obviously, to help determine, eliminate this thing about other life forms on some other thing in some other place in the universe, is that elements emit, when the light is shined on, we pick the colors, obviously, like oxygen, when you know, ignited, obviously, it early turns blue. So you see blue stars, you know, they have some, oxygen in there, some purplish blue areas. Anyway, so by looking at spectral lines, basically, we've concluded that the whole universe has got the same elements that we have here on Earth. And you just recently talked about in the class that Earth is actually blessed to have every single element there is. When we look at other stars, we find some elements here, some there. We really don't find one that has all the whole spectrum of elements. That's another thing that makes Earth unique. So you can't invent some new element on some other planet, you know, to do that. The periodic table that we see here on Earth is the same periodic table that fills up the whole universe. So the answer is there can't be any other life, any other universe, anywhere.
Other than carbon life. Is that what you're saying?
It's just eliminated now. We have the knowledge to say that's not possible.
I think there's only one element that non-radioactive element that's not naturally occurring on Earth. We've made it.
Yeah, there's some man-made. It was only last for a few seconds.
No. Right, but there's a non-radioactive one that's not. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty remarkable in itself. Did that answer your question, John? Yeah. Okay, so
let me ask the first question.
I only got one answer to my question.
Oh, keep going.
I asked for two reasons why things can't be so tightly packed.
Magnetism?
Well, sort of. Well, Jamie? Right.
Gravitational pool.
Radiation.
Right.
Good job.
But it's a similar argument. See, here's the argument is often framed in the media about can a planet exist that would support life? There's another component to that, and that is that it has to exist for a long enough period for life to develop. And if a planet is in an area of the universe that is so chaotic that there's always it's in risk of being knocked out of its orbit, or its sun is going to go supernova, or there's other galaxies or solar systems whizzing by that are going to destabilize it. It doesn't matter that it might now be in a state where it could support life in a few 100,000 years, it might not be able to, because the area that it's in is so chaotic. And so if there were a lot of stuff around us, it would disrupt the gravitational pull of the sun towards the planets, and it may kick us out or in. That's another reason why there's not a lot of stuff around us. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and to tag on what Matthew talked about recently, how we have to have, you know, microbe biology life on a planet for billions of years to make it suitable for advanced life.
That's right.
You can't do it in a short period of time.
I think there have been about 50 or 60, quote, Earth-like, unquote, planets that they've discovered that could sustain life.
Well, the first part of your sentence is true. They've found 50, I don't know if that number's right, but some Earth-sized planets. But the other half of your question is not true. They're not anywhere close to looking like what our planet is in a way that they could support life.
Doesn't Hugh also...
Matthew was talking about, we haven't found a single star that's capable of supporting life. If we find a star that's capable of supporting life, finding the planet is irrelevant.
Yeah. You've tried three times now.
Doesn't Hugh say that even our Earth or our galaxy will not be able to sustain life for more than about another 8,000 years or something?
Yeah,
like that?
40,000. That's a really interesting argument, because there's always the chance that some star, close star, is going to go supernova, which would bathe us in radiation. There's always the chance that some meteor or something is going to come from outer space and crash into us. Those are unlikely, but they're very possible. But then what's the main reason is, Dave, is it the...
What's your question?
We're going to run out of resources. Why are we only going to be viable for another 40,000 years or something?
That's for an advanced technological...
Right.
There'll be life here longer, but the sun is heating up.
That was it.
And it's... a small amount every century, but it is heating up, and in another 30,000 years, the Earth will be so hot that it's going to be very difficult for advanced life to live here.
The flip side of that is the rotation is getting slower, and so days will get hotter and nights will get colder.
Yeah. Well, that's more, much longer term, though. Yeah, you're millions of years from that.
That ends in the sun.
Yeah.
Isn't it supposed to have a lifespan of another 7 to 8 billion years?
Correct.
Not quite that long, I don't think, but 4 to 5, I think is what I've been hearing.
Yeah,
that's just the sun itself before it basically burns out. And things like the changes that will happen on the Earth are going to be much, much sooner than that.
Yeah,
but the sun is changing in its flaring activity, and it's changing in its brightness, too.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that that's going on the Earth is the effect of the sun going through later stages of life, where it becomes much more unstable, if you will, brighter and cooler periods, causing the burning of the Earth and freezing and that sort of thing cycles as well.
Ruth?
On the night, it happened to be in a fairly narrow period of time where the sun is extremely stable.
On a lighter note,
only if you're a long-term planner.
Yeah.
Once that sun burns up, it won't matter when God becomes our light in the new heavens and new earth.
Yeah.
So God knew that.
Okay, I got a question that kind of relates to everything we've been talking about. Practical question. How does your view of the night sky change when you go from the city to the country? Why does it change? Light pollution, right? And okay, so why ask this question though?
Bodies of
stars.
We would want stars, a lot of galaxies. If we were, instead of being in between a spiral arm, if we were in a spiral arm, we were too close to too many stars.
Right.
It'd be too bright.
And all of you have been to the desert or up in the mountains and seen, you know, the brilliant stars and the Milky Way. And so that's the glory of God. We're seeing it. And but, you know, when you're in the city, even though there may not be any clouds, what do you see? Only the very brightest stars. And so all you got to do is drive up to Mount Wilson and look up, though, and you'll see, 100 times more stars. So what if there was a star cluster closer to the Earth? That would be just like the light pollution that we're producing. So we'd see less and less stars, only the biggest ones. And so that's a good comparison, city light pollution, to what it would be like if there was some big stars right near us.
You know, I have a little bit different answer for that, and that is, the question is, how does your view of the night sky change when you go from the city to the country? Because you can, for me, because I can see the sky when I go to the country, I pay more attention to it. And I slow down a little bit, and I appreciate it, and I thank God for it. You look at the sky here in L.A., and there's nothing to see, so you don't spend a lot of time looking at it. I don't slow down enough to really pay attention to it. It's part of the, I don't know how many of you camp. I love to go camping, and that's part of the fun of it, is to lay out there, campfire, or wander off and just stare at the sky, and it looks so in your face.
That's an interesting analogy. The night sky in L.A. is so dark that you cannot see the light.
Yeah, there you go. Val?
Well, that might be part of the reason why city dwellers in advanced civilizations have a tendency to kind of forget God, while agricultural societies, even primitive societies, are more quick to accept Christ because they see his hand in the night sky. It's real obvious.
There's more atheists in the city than in the country.
You said there's two things. One is the stars, the other one is obviously his last contact with animals. And that's another Bible verse that says, you know, talk to the animals, they'll teach you, they'll tell you. Over in the city, we don't have any animals talking to us, but then our cats are gone.
Tranquilized bears.
Well, they're not tranquilized.
Rats and possums.
So, yeah. You're out in the country, you're out for being born, you know, you have a different perspective.
Okay. In what context?
Ruth has a question.
I'm sorry, Ruth, I can't see her.
Just the other day, a friend of mine said that, well, how about those primitive cultures? How will they connect with God? Will they be able to go to heaven if they never hear about God? And those are the places where all the billions of stars are. They can see, you know, those out in the boonies, out in the corners of the earth. They'll probably see more of the revelation of God than, like we said, than here. Here we take it, you know, take it for granted. And people don't realize those people are making assumptions here is because of where they live. Go over there, go to that culture, and you'll see, wait a minute, it's all around them.
You know what all of these arguments really boil down to is that in the city we have a much stronger sense that we can control things. And in the country, I think there's less of that sense because you are interacting with the animals, you're looking at the sky, you're a little more vulnerable to just natural stuff. And here we think we've got it figured out, we control our environment.
She was also, I like this when you say that because you're paraphrasing more than one, just to let you know.
Are we ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. In what context is darkness a good thing?
To sleep there for one.
I don't know why I didn't think of that.
Control the Jamie. Expansion rate of the universe.
Darkness? You're talking about dark energy.
Dark energy.
Well, what are the forms of darkness? What are the dark stuff that we've been learning about? There's dark energy, like Jamie just said.
Dark,
exotic dark matter and ordinary dark matter. Those three things. So, what? The question is, why are they good?
They hold everything together.
Yeah, exactly. They're fine-tuned, and one of the things they do is, and I think you've all heard about it, how recently they found that dark matter is in a halo around many galaxies. And you've got ordinary dark matter, and then exotic dark matter is also in a more distant halo around very large galaxies and galaxy clusters. So they're helping to fine-tune the gravitational effects that holds everything together.
Now, you and I need to define these. And last night we came up with a couple of good analogies.
For what?
Ordinary dark matter. It sounds very complicated. Well, think about the word ordinary and dark. Ordinary means it's everywhere. Dark means it doesn't emit light. So if you want a good example of ordinary dark matter, just look at yourself in a mirror. Okay.
With the lights off.
With the lights off. Yeah. Thank you. Anything, the Earth and pretty much everything in it is an example of ordinary dark matter because it's ordinary, it's all over the place, and it's not emitting light. Okay, now we go to exotic dark matter. And Hugh says exotic dark matter doesn't interact well with visible light. Well, what if think about what that means. It means it's invisible. Okay? You can't see it, and that's why we're having so much trouble finding it. We know it's there because it exerts gravity. Mm-hmm. Think about the old Invisible Man movies, okay? And there'd be some invisible guy walking along, but he'd still leave footprints in the sand. Okay, that's exotic dark matter. Mm-hmm. It really does exist. It has
exotic dark matter is exerting gravity.
The
thing I was going to test that they first discovered this was they went down into some of the deepest dug mines that we have, you know, mile down, you know, these diamond mines are way, way, way down there.
But they put up some
very, very sensitive instruments.
Correct.
And they found particles whizzing through the tunnel. And it's like, no, wait a second, you know, like we're insulated by, you know, a mile worth of dirt and rock. Yeah. And there shouldn't be any elements whizzing through the tunnel. Of course, for years, they just kept saying, well, the instrument must be wrong, and they just took more and more. Yeah. But the same thing with the background radiation. They discovered that, and they just assumed their instruments were broken. And it took years before everybody looked at their instruments and realized, no, everybody's instrument is the same. The instruments aren't broken. And so that's when they first discovered this thing. They've done some more tests since then. So they found out that, obviously, there are these particles that are whizzing directly through Earth, you know, deep mind.
What are those particles, Dave?
Those are neutrinos.
They are.
Yeah. And that's exotic dark matter.
That's one type of... In fact, as far as I know, that's the only one they've really identified. There are they think there's much larger particles.
I'm not aware that neutrinos are exotic dark matter. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. They go right through you, right through the planet.
They are classified as that.
Yeah.
Because according to... the renowned astrophysicist Stephen Hawking, the only elements that can escape a black hole is neutrinos.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't directly.
That's pretty exotic.
Quite a mechanical mechanism that wasn't coming through.
That
go ahead.
Seems to be ignoring the most obvious demonstration of dark, exotic dark matter. And that's just to see this gravitational effect on the galaxies by means of material we have no possibility of seeing anything through.
You're right.
That's the other answer to your question. It's partly what Dave said, but also, if you look at all the stuff in the universe that we can see, and you do the math, it shouldn't behave, given the gravitational attraction of the stuff we can see, the universe shouldn't behave the way it's behaving. The only way to explain the behavior that we're seeing is much, much more mass than what we can see.
Okay, now I'm familiar with some of that stuff, because you take a stealth bomber and you can define where a stealth bomber is by background. You know your background should be at a certain, call it picture, focus, or whatever, and you've got something buzzing in front of it because it distorts that.
Right.
But I can get that correlation with dark matter. It has an effect, but we don't know what it's doing.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's how we come up with the percentage. You know, the mind test doesn't tell us the percentage. You know, what he's talked about, obviously, is what gives us the percentage of where we come up with the number of how much percent the universe must be the dark matter.
That's an interesting...
Did anybody answer that question, though? Is darkness a good thing? Or in what context is it? Yeah. Otherwise, things wouldn't hold together, right?
Well, the other obvious one is what we've been talking about all night, is the fact that if we didn't have darkness, we wouldn't be able to see the whole universe.
Mm-hmm.
The light pollution idea.
Mm-hmm. Right. Ruth?
If darkness is a good thing, then why did they correlate darkness with evil? Is there a spiritual realm in the dark matter that floats the particles? Is there any spiritual realm in it?
You know, that's really interesting, because
I
asked you this once. I said maybe the spiritual realm has to do with dark matter.
That's in the fourth dimension.
Yeah.
Because we can't see the fourth dimension.
I think that, I mean, this is just what I flash on when you ask that. In the Bible, God is said to be a God of light. He illuminates. And I see that in two different ways. He illuminates our mind so we can see things more clearly. He illuminates the truth. But in Revelation, it talks about him actually emitting light. And so the opposite of that would be darkness. So the dark side, you know, dark humor, dark side, that's sort of a natural way to describe.
I think I'd be careful about trying to equate or put a correlation between dark matter, dark energy, and this dark spiritual.
No, I'm not making that correlation.
Well, I think she was suggesting that in her question.
Yeah.
I think that looking at darkness as being something you can't see, such as a multi-dimensional or higher number of dimensions, could be related with that, but not something that is a particular physical location within our universe.
Well, you know, let's read a Bible verse, okay, and I think it'll clear it up. Someone go to John 3, 19 through 21, and if you want, you could start with John 3:16 to read the whole paragraph. You want to do it, Janet?
Okay, starting with 16.
Tell me when you get to 19, okay?
Okay. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. 17. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. 18. He who believes in him is not condemned, but he who does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. 19. And this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil.
Okay, then there we're using light in a metaphoric sense. What's good and what's evil in this passage? Good is light or Jesus, and evil is dark. So that's the spiritual way to use it. As far as incorporating dark matter into it, exotic or ordinary dark matter, I'm not sure how, although Ross made a good point about Jesus, you know, radiating light when he, remember when he became transfigured with, I think it was Peter and John were there, and what was that?
Doesn't darkness equate to evil because of the fact that in the dark you don't know what's going on, there's a lot of unknowns, but in the light there can also be a lot of evil? Because
just the normal thing. Sure, but at least you can see.
They want to usually want to do it in the dark so that people don't see.
Okay. So that word light and dark can be used many ways.
Mark, what is pretty interesting, obviously, this whole issue, this verse about the dark stuff or whatever, is probably, gosh, it has to be 10 years ago. I was sharing with somebody, you know, reading Mr. Lee's Bible, obviously, and talking about it. You know, the Bible is. Is accurate when it talks about the physical world and predicts, you know, things and signs ahead of time. And this is the one verse that the guy actually threw up at me saying, well, no, look at here, you know, you know, darkness is just the absence of light, you know, so how can you say it's someone or whatever? And obviously, I wish I knew what the guy was. I could come back and say, you know, you asked the question just a little too soon, you know. So a lot of times we find these quote-unquote errors in the Bible years later, the sign just comes out, and it's not an error at all, and it's amazing. You know, scientific prediction, as we talked about.
How many times has that happened in history? So many times. Yeah. People think they've got it on the Bible, and they say, what about this? And some day later, we find out that it's the truth.
If I remember correctly, when dark matter emerged, they didn't have any better acronym for it than dark stuff, because it was an unknown. And now we have degrees of dark matter. They could have called it quantity A, B, and C, for that matter also.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, here's another one on darkness. In what context, that's plural, is darkness not a good thing? And the second part of the question, how did God provide for these situations?
Bruce answered that.
Yeah, this is like the third question you've asked that we've already answered.
I want more details. Okay. Yeah.
Mark, kind of throws back to last week, but we were talking about the expansion of the universe and being just the right space now in time for that light to have reached us so we can see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we just talked about the cosmic background with radiation, so we don't really see all the way back to that. Because I was trying to understand how come we don't see that light past us, that would seem creation like, wouldn't it?
Yeah, the reason we can't see any further back is because there was a point at a certain age in that, I don't remember if that was exactly 380,000 years, but it was about that, where the universe before that was opaque. You could not see anything inside. It was only that it became.
It was so hot that all the elements of the atom hadn't coalesced together, so you can't go back.
So if you were this far away from something else, then you wouldn't see it because it was completely opaque. You're inside at that time. So as that expands to that point, you can't see beyond there because that visibility within that 380,000 years doesn't exist.
It wasn't emitting any photons that we could see.
Photons, yeah.
Well, photons would be absorbed instantly by any ion that was, or proton that was there.
I'm trying to think of it in terms of opacity, though. Something is opaque, something is transparent, and it very suddenly became transparent from that time, to where you could see within that space of what was going on. But before that time, if you had been inside of there, maybe the universe was, 100 million miles in diameter, pretty small compared to today, you could be in there and you wouldn't be able to see somebody standing right next to you because it's opaque. Just like if you were standing inside of a solid piece of aluminum, you wouldn't be able to see somebody else's solid piece of aluminum or black water or whatever.
That's like a two-dimensional object trying to identify a three-dimensional object.
Right.
It's not really the same thing.
The fact is the universe was too dense. Too dense and too hot.
Like fog.
Light because it was too hot and too dense.
There's no light, and if we could have existed there and seen it, we couldn't see it because it didn't exist.
What about a new theory that says this has happened before?
You're talking about an oscillating universe, or
this is the Big Bang has happened before.
Well, that would be it.
Before this Big Bang.
Okay, and then what happens?
I don't know, but I haven't read the whole thing. It sounds like this oscillating universe idea, the multiverse idea, to where these things happen and kind of go off in multidimensional space at different times, different places. We can't communicate with those, or it's one universe that gets big and then it eventually collapses.
Yeah, because they didn't define multidimensional. Yeah, but they left that part alone.
But that idea, that concept of other Big Bangs
but there's not. John, is what you're asking about the oscillating universe, where it there's a Big Bang, it expands and then it contracts, it goes back and it bangs again and keeps doing that. Yeah,
there's just one of the models. Looking more generally.
Right.
Okay.
Anybody know what's wrong with that theory and why it can't be? Or can it be?
Well, this universe can't be.
What do we know that's going on in this universe then, Dave?
The first and second law of thermodynamics are laws. You can't get around them, you can't pick them. And this universe has such a high entropy, which means that energy is going from order to disorder, that if this universe was to collapse, there wouldn't be enough energy to start again on another thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But also now we know, just from these measurements we talked about, getting of the dark energy, the dark matter and stuff, we know also now that there's not enough mass in this universe to make it stop and to collapse.
It's going to keep expanding.
That's not a possibility either. But even if it did collapse, there's not enough energy to make it bang and to start
right.
So why is it expanding at an ever increasing faster rate?
That goes with the dark energy. Dark energy actually is like you described as being the opposite of Rho band, is that as the universe gets larger, it's going to expand faster because the dark energy actually is making the universe expand faster.
Then what is the length and breadth of the universe? Infinite?
No.
Then you have to get into observable or actual. That's obviously gets into a whole other conversation.
Well, in either case, it's not infinite. Yeah.
But the diameter of the observable universe would be double its age, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be 13.7 times 2 billion light years?
Minimum.
Right.
It could be a lot bigger than that, too. Because it's expanding. Yeah, we can't see all the light and
right.
know everything that's going on because the surface is curved. And
but
it's not infinite, no.
Are we able to ascertain the limit of the universe from the light way back when originally? Yes.
Yes, that's the back radiation we talked about. That's the direct measurement of the universe back, just back to the second of the day.
Mark, you got a question?
That's not a visible light you're looking at. So it's but it's all lights traveling at the same speed, no matter what the
C. Yeah, they call it C.
Okay, so that cosmic background radiation that we're looking at is something at a certain million light years back. Is that what it is? It's all about that same distance.
It's about 13.7, a little shy.
Billion.
Billion.
That distance that they do the calculation of.
Yeah.
So they're saying that's the farthest back we see. That's not a visible light then.
That's all, but it is electromagnetic radiation. So it's in, like I said, in the same category.
That's basically effectively black body radiation that has cooled to 3 degrees Kelvin in that 13.7 billion years. That's the cooling that has occurred from something super hot, trillions of degrees.
Oven analogy I was using. You open up the door and you measure the temperature around the room and determine how long ago the oven and how hot it was. And so then in the background radiation, we know that from the age, we also know that this thing started almost. I think if you have not known the background radiation, the other thing is over the entire skies, no matter where you look, that temperature is everywhere. And then our instruments are good enough now that we know that background radiation has slight fluctuation of a fraction of a degree. And that fluctuation is what helps clump the material together to make galaxies. If we hadn't had that fluctuation, we wouldn't have the variety of galaxies that we have. So that means that, again, that the fine tuning of the beginning of the universe is just incredible.
Jamie?
I'm confused.
You're not the only one.
Now, the background, I thought you were saying that the observable, what we've seen with the background and the cosmic background radiation was 380. And then we calculate further back.
Correct.
No, yeah, not 380.
It's you've got the number off. The concept's right.
No, it's not 380 million years ago. It's 380 million years after the creation of the
380,000,
and it's 380,000, not 380 million. Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Then you calculate from back there using the
math.
The polarization, right?
Right.
You can observe the polarization, and by understanding the characteristics of polarization,
yeah, if you took you're moving my two fists together, you go backwards in time with the universe expanding, and you get to about right there, and you stop, well, you can predict mathematically how long it would take for it to come together at a point, and that's what they do.
And just to be clear, obviously, that is only one of about a dozen methods we measure the universe. The reason we're so precise on the universe, when Hugh now says 13.7 on several decimal places, is we have measured the universe about 12 different ways now, and every one of those measurements comes out exactly correct. So whether you're doing redshift, whether we're doing a measured light of particular types of stars that explode,
temperature,
background radiation, all these different methods, all come out correct. So, I've had people that have argued and said, well, that's not the age. And I'm saying that's like you going to 12 different stores, buying a 1 foot roller and laying them all up together, and they all
are exactly verification,
and telling me, no, that's not really a foot. It's totally ridiculous. Anybody that denies the age of the universe, might as well deny, the age of every ruler in every store in America then, because once you measure something 12 ways and you come up with exactly the same answer, that's the age. Anybody that argues with it, again, obviously, is irrational.
Your standard is wrong.
Ruth? Ruth was first. Hang on a second. That's all right.
Okay. I want to teach this to students, for example. How am I going to define the Big Bang? There's, you know, evolution, Big Bang, and the Darwinism, and the Christian Big Bang. How do I define the easy one?
Why don't you light a firecracker in the middle of your school room? But that's really a good analogy. It starts. You start with something that's all in one place, and then all of a sudden, it explodes and goes out. And you can say this is how everything you see in the sky when you go out at night, go to the darkest place you can find and look at it. Every one of those stars at one time was all in one little tiny speck, smaller than you can think about. Then God lit the firecracker, and it's still exploding.
Something, it's not good to use the word explode. It's like a controlled expansion.
Yeah.
Because it's designed so carefully.
It's not chaotic.
The wrong one is...
The other one Hugh uses, obviously, is the firecracker gives the analogy of chaos. Is he likes to do this on stage number five. He'll take a balloon and put black dots on the balloon and then blow the balloon up and ask the kid what happens to the black dots. And you look, the black dots expand. And as the balloon gets bigger...
And get further from each other.
...faster. And that's exactly what's happened in the universe. So, we talked about the galaxies and everything on the matter of all the surface of the universe. And as the universe is getting larger, the galaxies are spreading apart further away. The cool thing is, we talked about, because light takes time to travel, the further away we look, and the further we look back on that balloon, we're looking at the balloon when it's smaller and the galaxies are closer together. So the Hubble telescope, when it sees the deep field, the galaxies are all close together and packed. And as you look at things closer, the galaxies get further apart. And that was another observable thing that you can see, obviously, of the universe expanding further away. And the other thing is, when you look at things farther away, you look at all these young galaxies and young stars, you look at things close, we look at the same old galaxies with old stars. You win. You know, there's directly a correlation of all these measurements.
I think I got a good answer for her question.
In that class, just take a balloon, put black dots on it, blow it up, and those kids will watch the dots get further and further apart. And that's exactly what the universe
is. No, you don't want it to explode.
Ruth, I think... I think...
Although the Bible does say it will disappear in fire, so if you want to light a match under it, that would be...
Fill it full of helium. I mean hydrogen.
I think I have a good way for you to do it. Tell all your kids, clear out all the chairs in your room, and get all your kids to stand in the middle of the room together, like get as tight as you can, and then tell them all to walk towards the wall, and they'll all walk in different directions towards the wall. Yeah, and you can stop them like a third of the way out, and you can say, okay, this is about where we are now. You know, look around, you're getting further and further from each other as you walk, and then have them walk all the way to the walls. And do it in the playground. That's even better. Yeah.
Ideally, you'd be going in all directions, though.
Right.
Three-dimensionally.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Jamie.
I think he was next, though.
Yeah.
Go ahead, John.
I was thinking about the Earth. It's very unlikely that an asteroid's ever going to hit us. Okay, fine. But what about radiation? How much of the Earth's atmosphere would it take to damage the Earth?
Yeah, I want to answer that because you got something first. You talked about the exploding stars that actually have happened in the past, and because of the diameter of Earth and the density of Earth is one of the densest things, the size of our core, that when a star explodes, they only usually put out radiation for about 12 to 30 seconds. And so only kills life on half the planet. That actually has happened to our planet several times in the past, where all life on one side of the planet, you know, would be exposed to radiation and die. And the life on the other side of the planet had to repopulate, and we have evidence of that. So an exploding star close to us would only wipe off half.
There are some, Dave, that last longer than... Yeah, they'll last a day or more.
I mean, Hugh is saying the Vela supernova, we're still seeing the remnants of that, and that's...
Yeah, but the radiation...
Not the deadly radiation.
Right.
Radiation versus things. So, yes, we still see the remnant of the dying ashes, but the actual radiation that's enough to kill you is usually not enough to kill.
Can you give me an event where half the planet died because of some radiation that hit the Earth? No, can you give me an event?
give the event, not off the top of my head, you know, go on the internet and do some research.
Yeah, supernova events. I think Hugh once said that they occur on deadly ones every, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand years or so.
Okay, let's go back to the 40,000 years. Why 40,000 years?
Oh, for the possible length of time for advanced life on this planet. That was the 40,000 year. Although he has lowered that since then to 10,000 at times.
I think that's a pretty generic number, but it has.
For advanced, and he says if you want to continue beyond that, you'd have to get back into a Stone Age thing where you're not, you know, using, you know.
We're going to run out of fossil fuels, is one of them.
The specific reason for that, I don't recall off the top of my head, we discussed it in our class with him.
I can tell you the other primary reason why advanced civilization is going to kill off itself, and it's already happening right now, is right now the world population is growing, and this was a theory several years ago, and now it's pretty much been confirmed that because of the dropping birth rate, as soon as the community gets advanced civilization, supplied electricity, lights, television, radio, and stuff, the birth rate nearly drops. And right now, with our current birth rate, there's no indication of a change. And in 50 years, the world population will take a nosedive. So the next 50 years, the resources are going to be very scarce. We'll have aging population. They're expecting, you know, problems, obviously, because there's not going to be enough women for men, because obviously there's more men on the planet. There are women, obviously, coming up that direction. And so world population is going to drop. Europe is already heading that direction. And so with the world population dropping, obviously, again, the only way to get back up is to do an advanced civilization.
Yeah, well, South America and Africa, their populations are booming.
South America is getting electricity, and their population is dropping. Africa, I agree, obviously, and some other places that don't have electricity, that's true, but it's not the case for South America. But again, if you're going to South America right now, the next 50 years, it will drop. Every model shows that in 50 years, the world population will drop. You can go research yourself.
But what he's saying is that if that's the case, then the resources should last longer.
Yes. No, we'll be using up those resources in the next 50 years.
I disagree with that.
Yeah. Well, I'm not, obviously, Hugh put this thing at 40,000 years. What I'm talking about is obviously not happening in that time period, obviously. You know, with natural gas is about 300 years, oil, anywhere from 250 to 300 years.
Dave, a little bit longer term would be like the sun. You know, it's stable condition, destabilizing, and that's, we're starting to go into that cycle.
There's a lot of
the sun will heat up, it'll have more solar flares,
and that
will sputter the atmosphere away. The Earth will heat up, and the ozone layer will be destroyed. Then you have so much radiation, UV radiation hitting the surface of the Earth, it's going to cause mutations of all species, not just humans. So that's kind of where he gets the 10 to 40,000 year limit for advanced civilization. It deals directly with the sun.
So, you know, it's interesting because this is one of the atheists' great comments is that, you know, we're going to live, our race can keep on living. And if Hugh's right that we have 40,000 years or whatever it is, whatever that number is, even if we never, imagine that we never ran out of resources, which we will, but imagine that we don't. We're still doomed as a race on this planet. That's pretty sobering.
So Mars, Jupiter, Saturn.
40,000 years.
No, I don't believe that. Okay.
Well, once again, you knew the research then.
No, I don't
want to believe it. That's why.
You don't believe it. If you want us to...
No, I do believe we can do that.
You know, if someone wants to do research over the week, please bring it back. Or if you want Ross and I to, you know, let us know, and we'll see what we can come up with. Okay, we'll try to get some more information on it.
That's out there called Lights in the Sky, and we will bring that and do thoroughly exhaust that.
Since this seems to be a popular topic and there's differing opinions here, that might be a good thing to, you know, research and present next week, is, you know, what some of these timetables are.
That's a good idea. Yeah,
we can show the time.
We'll look into that.
Yeah, because Hugh's not doing that on the...
You and I got nothing to do.
No, we got nothing to do. But we'll talk about it. Yeah, Mark.
star cluster, everything gets tighter and tighter as you look back, visible light. Mm-hmm. Is that everywhere that we're looking around, we see that? Because it's already expanded, that's what we're seeing.
And remember, remember the analogy of the ball, okay? If you're living on the on this planet, you can't see through the planet. The shortest line to somewhere else is a curve, okay? And it's the same way we live on a three-dimensional surface of a four-dimensional ball. And so our perception of things, like why hasn't the light, the cosmic background radiation long since outpaced us? Those, you can't think about it that way. I mean, I hung up on that question for years. I still am. It's like, this doesn't work for me. But the way that we picture the universe in our head isn't the way it really is. You can't really picture it. Even people who are great at the math, you can't picture it the way it really is. It's you sort of have to just take it. You just have to believe them when they say it doesn't work that way.
I'll give you the observational effects. What I'm talking about, the direct observation, is there's two deep fields, Hubble deep fields, if you want to see it, you know, Google Hubble deep field, and there's two spots. We found one spot here in the northern hemisphere, one spot in the southern hemisphere. And what they did was point the Hubble telescope at the darkest place in the sky that they could find, and they thought there was nothing there. And they exposed the Hubble telescope to that area for the equivalent of, I remember what you said, a week or two, where we collected the light from that area. And the way the CCD camera works is that light will add, it keeps adding and adding and adding. And then they were totally amazed that when you finally got done with that very long exposure, that what everybody thought was dark and nothing was there turned out to be light that left those galaxies 13 billion light years ago. And that's where you see all these galaxies all piled together very, very close. And then again, by measuring how far the galaxies are away now, how far away and close they are together again, that's another direct measurement observation of proving that the universe is 13.7 billion years. That's direct observational. So people that don't understand redshift, people that don't understand background radiation, the temperature and stuff, I just show them the Hubble duck field and I say, this is what the universe looks like today. You know, these galaxies are really far apart. Here's a baby picture of the universe. And they can understand that. It's like, look, here's a picture of you in your crib. This is the universe in its crib with all the galaxies all packed together as a little tiny baby, and they can understand that. And so I like Hubble deep field. I share with everybody because it's direct, it's observational. You don't have a high school education to understand that. You know, it's very simple. It's direct observation.
It's on page 32 in your textbook, if for those of you that have a text. And it's not a great picture, but
it's not color.
But just look at it real close.
And just remember that every one of those specks on there, every one of those little tiny specks is an entire galaxy with 200 billion stars on average each.
Right. And that they, remember, this is a spot, like Dave said, they thought there was nothing there. They were just fooling around with a space shuttle. Excuse me. And so within that little field, let's see, how many galaxies did they find?
The other key is that black spot that you see. If you were to zoom in and those black spots between those galaxies, then you would see nothing there.
Exactly.
Because that would get back to what you were talking about. It's just black. There was no light.
That's the limit. You're going before light.
You have to see the limit of the universe. If you zoomed in more and more and more, did more exposure, those black areas would stay black. There's nothing beyond there because you're looking now at the very big first picture of the universe. It
says there was 10,000 galaxies. And that little tiny thing, smaller than the diameter of the full moon, I think like a quarter of it. And so then they extrapolated for the entire sky surrounding, the Earth. And that's how they came up with 200 billion galaxies, not counting dwarf galaxies, of course. And so that was quite an observation. Yeah, if you look at that real close, you can see that each dot is actually a galaxy. Mostly elliptical. Spherical and a few. I don't see any.
There's a few spirals in there, not many. It's pretty much the same kind of makeup we have right now.
Yeah.
Very few spirals.
It's very few. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to ask everybody, we don't have to end with this, but we're getting close to the end. I'd like to ask everybody, what does this matter to you? How do you relate these very scientific, in-your-head ideas to your faith? You, and I'm asking each person personally, what impresses you? What reaction do you have towards God that's different than before you learned this stuff?
Other than Dave Sargent, because I know he's got good answers. But you know all the answers, Dave. So, Norma, did you have something?
I was just going to say that my husband's prayers have been so in depth since he's been coming to Jesus.
Why do you think that is?
It's making him think harder, is that it?
Well, I have been reading his books for years. He just started over a year ago, uh-huh. And he's read a lot already. I think we have all of his books, and he's always reading this. He's always reading this. His prayers, actually, I was telling him yesterday, they're so intense, and they're praising God, and he goes into specifics of his creation, and his prayers were not like that before. They were simple, short, to the point, and that's it. You know, very
okay.
Short. Now it's in length.
Oh.
And he's giving a lot of praise. I told him that it's awesome to hear you pray with me.
Okay, but you're taking Psalm 19 to heart, aren't you, Mark? Okay. Tim?
Overall, this idea that he has put forth to me has given me a lot better confidence in my Christian faith. I come from a non-Christian background for most of, at least half my life anyway, but yet throughout my entire life been very strongly scientific and very technically oriented, needing quantitative, exact answers to things, having studied science and the universe and whatnot, and finding a big disconnect there to say, I can't believe in a God who would have something that he says in the Bible be in conflict with what I see in nature. It's my experience in my life and what I know to be correct, or what I know to be accepted by the scientific community. And to see how he has put all this together in his works and his speeches and his answers to responses to questions has allowed me to bring these two sources, these two revelations, as he likes to call them, together into complete harmony. And that has strengthened my faith immeasurably.
Pete?
I go back, so I know whom I have believed. But now I'm learning what he did and how he did it. And for me, because I love science, I love reading and studying the Bible, I love my Lord, I appreciate what he did, it's exciting to see how he did it. You know, I mean, it's kind of like, wow, pretty smart guy.
It's kind of like learning how they do the magic trick, you know?
There you go.
Who else?
Yeah, John.
John.
Yeah, I'm just still in awe of the universe, and that awe takes me to the Creator. It's hard to imagine someone, this just happens serendipitously.
Okay, very good. Everybody in here is pretty much sort of science oriented to some degree, and that sort of pushes you to God. No, you aren't, but you're what is it, Ruth? I mean, why do you, can you touch on what Ross
about science? Oh my God. Okay. But I am extremely drawn to this because it deals with my Maker. I love my God so much, and anything he's created, it just excites me. Oh. I want to know more about him, and the more I find out the fine-tuning of every little thing he's done, it gets me more excited about him.
Okay.
And that's why I want to know more.
Anybody?
She also expressed something very beautiful last Wednesday. Remember when you said fine-tuning, if he was able to do this or something like that? You said
if he can fine-tune the universe, he can definitely be very interested in the fine-tuning of the details of our life.
Yeah, that was good.
There's a huge connection there.
Mm-hmm. Colleen, Jim, anybody else? Dwight? Okay.
Now, I grew up in the 1950s in Pasadena, and I remember seeing all my dad and I would go out and we'd see all the stars and the Orion and the Big Dipper and the Pleiades, and you don't see much of that anymore. In fact, my sister and I, she'll call me up and she'll say, "Hey, Jim, Venus and Jupiter and the moon are all together, you know, and it's really something, at least you can see that now."
Yeah.
A few years ago, my brother-in-law was working out at Ryan, which is kind of in the east part of Death Valley. The U.S. Borax Corporation found borax there in 1907, and they were there for 20 years. Well, now it's kind of a, they still own it, I guess, but he's gone there for he's an engineer, and they want to work on some of the buildings and everything. And I was out there with the president of the U.S. Borax Company. We stayed overnight. And he had these binoculars. I don't know what they are, but they're battery operated, so you can, no matter how you're moving, it's always still for the, you know, to look at. I'd like to get a pair of those, but I'm sure it's very expensive. But anyway, I mean, there's, Ryan is pitch black at night. There's nothing out there. I mean, a meteor shower would be something, but you can see the Milky Way. You can see everything. It's beautiful, and I just thank God for his awesome power and being able to make that for us. It's just, now I know I'm tiny, but I look at that.
You're tiny, but he counts you as a giant, you know, all of us.
But it's beautiful out there, you know, when you can get away from the lights.
Well, we'll be doing that in just, how many more days, Ross?
Yeah.
April 21st.
First.
9 days.
Mark?
Brenda, you know, we were talking about Job and what God asked Job about being there when they created Pleiades and I forgot the other one, but
Orion.
Yeah. Well, he said back then, as Job, that was much brighter in the sky, even if you were in a dark sky, desert location or a remote location here on Earth. It was much brighter back then. I'm not sure how much brighter it was, but I'm sure it was pretty obvious, because you can even see, I mean, if you look hard enough, even from the city, you can see both of them.
Yeah. Yeah, city lights go a long ways. You know, you can be out in the desert, to the Arizona border, and there's still some town nearby. Every human city is emitting electromagnetic radiation, you know, I mean, invisible, in the visible range. Back then, the most you had was a few fires burning at night in a few little towns. So, yeah, the sky was better.
The Pleiades is one of the ones, and I think I can look it up on the internet. I believe it was darker back when he told Job that. Yeah, I mean, it was brighter, much brighter
yeah.
in the sky.
The Pleiades are that, you know, that little group looks like a tiny little dipper. This is called the Seven Sisters, and it's real. It just stands out in the sky if you get in the desert here and you know, the LA Basin. It's visible.
Are they just stars or are they galaxies? I don't know what they are.
Those are stars.
Those are
yeah.
stars.
Pleiades is a star cluster.
Mm-hmm.
How far would they be? How many light years from?
Well, they're in our galaxy. Yeah,
he would know everyone down to the tenth of a.
They're not all at the same. They're around a star cluster. Yeah, probably 1,000 light years away.
The average person, I think, that reads that scripture verse, they don't get the impact of that question to Job, because they don't really realize what Pleiades is.
Yeah.
All right. And then once you realize it, you even realize more humbling the question. The more you learn about that, that's I get more humble. The more I learn all about this stuff. Yeah, more humbling the questions that God is asking us in Scripture. The more you learn them, it's just...
What's amazing is... Isn't it amazing that we figured out a little bit of it, though? I mean, you know, like, what is darkness?
Yeah.
You know, those questions that Job was asked.
I have a chart at home because I'm ignorant of science. But I have a chart, and I'm in chapter 6 now. But I'm praying something because I'm very visual. And of course, he's always helping me because I'm always asking him questions.
Good.
I want to answer my own question.
Well, don't wait too long, though.
All right. For me, when I go out, there's certain times, certain things that happen. A sunset in particular, when I can really see the stars, where to me it feels very personal and very intimate, like God is saying something directly to me, and He's right there. It's very immediate and intimate for me.
That's what happens with yard work, you know, when I'm planning and
growing
stuff. It's just awesome how nature just takes its course.
I think everybody has a place like that where the Lord speaks to them, and I think it's different for all of us. That's what I think is really cool. Jim?
I think that from where we stand, the distances, how far they are from us, that's awesome right there.
Yeah. Yeah, but when you think that you go out there and you look at some random star, and the photon of light that just happened to hit your eyeball when you were looking at it left that star thousands, millions, even billions of years ago, and it happened to land in your face, you know.
Yes.
It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
But God knew it was going to happen.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. All right, let's pray, everybody. Lord, we just barely scratched the surface on understanding what You've created for us and the splendor, the beauty, the magnitude, the hugeness of what You've created for us. And we're humbled. We're so grateful. We thank You for the love that it shows us and that You care about us and that You are a personal being. Thank You for this class, Lord. Thank You for the ability to take the science, to understand it the way You've given it to us, and then turn it into something that touches us and helps us have a closer relationship with You. Thank You. Please bless everyone as they go their way tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.
Okay, thank you, everybody. See you next week. Chapter 8.